Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Mario Ritter, Brian Lynn, and Anna Mateo. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Mario Ritter.
Special envoys for South Korean President Moon Jae-in reportedly met with North Korean leader Kim Jong-un Monday. Moon's office said the envoys were to meet with North Korean officials and to attend a dinner hosted by Kim. Observers note that this would be unusual for a North Korean leader. Kim has not met with any foreign leaders since he took power in 2011, after the death of his father, Kim Jong-il. Moon's national security advisor, Jong Hui-yong, led the 10-member delegation. The head of South Korea's National Intelligence Service is also in the delegation. The group traveled on a rare direct flight from Seoul to Pyongyang, the North Korean capital. The envoys brought a message from Moon about removing all nuclear weapons from the Korean Peninsula and peace between the two Koreas. Jung spoke to reporters before leaving for the trip. He said he would deliver President Moon's firm resolve to achieve a denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula and genuine and permanent peace on the Korean Peninsula. Jung said he would seek in-depth discussions to find a way to restart talks between North Korea and the U.S. For this, we plan to have in-depth discussion not only on South-North talks, but also ways to continue talks between North Korea and the international community, including the United States, he said. However, the diplomatic effort faces North Korean opposition to planned military drills to be held between the South and the U.S. in April. North Korea's KCNA news agency warned that the North would, in its words, counter the U.S. if it holds the joint exercises as currently planned. The military joint exercises were postponed because of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang, South Korea, last month. Kim Jong-un sent his sister and Chief of State Kim Yong-nam to the opening ceremonies of the Games. He also sent high-level party official Kim Yong-chol to the closing ceremonies. Moon spoke by telephone with U.S. President Donald Trump about the visit last week. After the two-day visit is complete, the South Korean special envoys are to travel to the U.S. to discuss their contact with the North. North Korean officials have told Moon that they are willing to restart talks with the U.S., and the U.S. president has said he also is willing to hold talks, but only under the right conditions. The U.S. placed another set of sanctions on the North last month that target individuals, companies, and ships. Those restrictions are in addition to United Nations Security Council sanctions put in place since early 2016. I'm Mario Ritter.
An American aircraft carrier has arrived at a Vietnamese port for the first time since the Vietnam War. The USS Carl Vinson arrived Monday in the central city of Da Nang and will remain for several days. Two other U.S. Navy ships are also visiting. The carrier has more than 5,000 crew members. The U.S. carrier's visit was first announced in January during a visit to Vietnam by U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. The two countries normalized relations in 1995 and have greatly expanded ties in many areas. A U.S. arms embargo was lifted in 2016. The arrival of the USS Carl Vinson marks the biggest U.S. military presence in Vietnam since the end of the Vietnam War in 1975. The U.S. ambassador to Vietnam, Daniel Critton Brink, said in a statement, "The historic visit shows the dramatic progress in U.S.-Vietnamese relations in recent years. Through hard work, mutual respect, and by continuing to address the past while we work toward a better future, we have gone from former enemies to close partners," the ambassador added. The first U.S. Marines arrived in Da Nang in 1965, marking the start of major American involvement in the Vietnam War. About 58,000 American soldiers and an estimated 3 million Vietnamese were killed in the war. Da Nang was a major U.S. military base during that time. It is now Vietnam's third largest city and a place many people visit for vacation. Some city residents said they welcomed the Navy visit. "During the war, I was scared when I saw American soldiers," 55-year-old Chung T. Luyen told the Associated Press. He operates a small shop in the city. Now the aircraft carrier comes with a completely different mission, a mission of peace and promoting economic and military cooperation between the two countries, he said. Huynh Quang Nguyen, a taxi driver, said he was happy and excited about the visit. "Increased cooperation between the two countries in economic, diplomatic, and military areas would serve as a counterbalance to Beijing's," he said. He was speaking about the growing influence of China across the region. "China has been building up man-made islands in the South China Sea in recent years that can support military structures. The expansion has angered Vietnam and other nations in the area, which also have territorial claims in the South China Sea." I'm Brian Lin.
A new study says more than 100,000 malaria cases went untreated in Liberia during the height of the Ebola crisis. The deadly virus spread in West Africa for 2 years, beginning in 2014. The disease killed about 11,000 people, but it also severely affected basic health care services. Ebola kills about half of those it infects. It causes flu-like effects first, then vomiting and diarrhea. It can lead to severe bleeding both inside and outside the body. The disease spreads through contact with an infected person's body fluids. Three countries were mainly affected in the West African spread: Sierra Leone, Guinea, and Liberia. None were well prepared to deal with the event. Many clinics did not even have the protective tools needed to safely deal with Ebola patients, like gloves and face masks. Bradley Wagoner was the lead researcher of the University of Washington study.
Rightfully so, people were afraid to go to the clinic because they might get Ebola when they're at the clinic.
The team looked at records from 379 clinics outside the Liberian capital, Monrovia. The records covered a period from 2010 through 2016. Wagoner says the researchers saw what he called a huge dramatic decrease in basic health care services early in the outbreak. They found measles vaccinations dropped by 67%, malaria prevention fell by 61%, and 35% fewer women got early pregnancy care. The researchers say it took a full year and a half for health services to return to the levels they were before the Ebola outbreak. The researchers estimate that a loss of a possible 750,000 clinic visits took place during the crisis. I'm Rachel Dennis.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. As we age, our ability to think and remember starts to deteriorate. But not everyone. Some of us have brains that age more slowly. Enter the superager. Superagers are people over the age of 80. Who have the brain structures and abilities of much younger people. 87-year-old Bill Guralnick is a superager.
What do I feel like? If I was to give a number, I probably feel like I'm about my early 70s.
Scientists know that parts of the brain decrease in size with age. But in superagers, that process is much slower. Emily Rogalski is a neuroscientist at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. In a recent study, she showed that superagers have young brains. The area of the brain responsible for attention and memory, the cortex, was shown to be thicker in superagers.
When we look at the cortex of their brain, we see that on average that it looks more like a 50-year-old brain than it looks like an average 80-year-old brain.
Not only do superagers have thicker cortexes, they have more von Economo neurons. These large brain cells appear to be involved with social-emotional communication. But their exact purpose is still a mystery. Scientists writing for Smithsonian Magazine also call them spindle neurons and say they are brain cells for socializing. Scientists say superagers have several things in common, including an active lifestyle. Many travel and play sports. They are often big readers. And they usually have healthy relationships and spend time with friends. Superagers also seem to have certain common personality traits. Rogalski says they are, for the most part, known for their optimism, resilience, and perseverance. Growing old, she adds, does not have to be depressing and sad.
Perhaps if we expected a bit better from ourselves, then we would understand that not all aging is doom and gloom.
As lead investigator of the study, Rogalski jokingly said that superagers do not grow on trees, meaning they are special and few. She says she wants to find out the reasons Guralnik's mind is working so well and not aging as quickly as most. Guralnik's own father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in his 50s. Solving this mystery, Rogalski says, may help those who suffer from brain diseases such as Alzheimer's.
We think if we can understand the factors contributing to superaging, it may offer new hypotheses and new ways to explore the challenges in Alzheimer's disease.
The science behind superaging is a relatively new but growing field. Scientists involved in the research offer this advice as we age. Stay active, learn new things, challenge yourself, surround yourself with healthy relationships. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The battle between the North and the South spread in the summer of 1861. Union soldiers fought pro-Southern rioters in the streets of Baltimore and St. Louis. A Confederate supporter shot and killed a young officer from the North. Untrained soldiers from both sides fought in the mountains of western Virginia. So far, though, the fighting had not claimed many lives. But very soon, the battle would become fierce. Frank Oliver and Jack Weitzel continue the story of the American Civil War.
The old general who commanded the Union forces, Winfield Scott, did not want to rush his men into battle. Scott believed it would be a long war. He planned to spend the first year of it getting ready to fight. He had an army of thousands of men, and it would get much larger in coming months. But this army was not trained. His soldiers were civilians, who knew nothing about fighting a war. General Scott needed time to make soldiers of these men. He also needed time to organize a supply system to get to his forces the guns, bullets, food, and clothing they would need. Without supplies, his army could not fight very long. There were many in the North, however, who thought Scott was too careful. It was true, they said, that Union forces were untrained, but so were those of the South. And the Confederacy's supply problems were even greater than those of the Union. The South had much less industry and fewer railroads. It could not produce as much military equipment, and it could not transport supplies as easily as the North could. In the early months of the war, Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president, did not even have guns enough for the men in his army. Those who demanded immediate action expected a short war. They said Scott should take the army and march to Richmond. They were sure that if Union forces seized the Confederate capital, the Southern rebellion would end. Northern newspapers took up the cry, "On to Richmond." Political leaders began pressing for a quick Northern victory. Public pressure forced the Army to act. For more than a month, General Irvin McDowell had been building a Union army in Northern Virginia, just across the Potomac River from Washington. He had more than 30,000 men at bases in Arlington and Alexandria. Late in June, McDowell received orders. March against the Confederate Army of General Pierre Beauregard. Beauregard had 20,000 soldiers at Manassas Junction, a railroad village in Virginia, less than 50 kilometers from Washington. McDowell planned to move on Manassas Junction July 9th, but was delayed for more than a week. He planned the attack carefully. McDowell was worried that another large Confederate force west of Manassas Junction might join Beauregard's army. This force, led by General Joe Johnston, was in the Shenandoah Valley near Harper's Ferry, Virginia. Across from Harper's Ferry in Maryland was a Union army almost twice the size of Johnston's. It was ordered to put pressure on Johnston's force to prevent it from helping Beauregard. General Beauregard received early warning from Confederate spies that McDowell would attack. Much of his information came from a woman, Mrs. Rose O'Neill Greenhow. Mrs. Greenhow, a widow, was an important woman in Washington. She knew almost all the top government officials, and she had friends in almost every department of the government. The beautiful Mrs. Greenhow also had some very special friends. One was Senator Henry Wilson of Massachusetts. He was chairman of the Senate Committee on Military Affairs. Another special friend was Thomas Jordan, a Confederate colonel in Beauregard's army. Jordan asked Mrs. Greenhow soon after the war started to be a spy for the South. She agreed and sent much valuable information about Union military plans. Early in July, she sent word to Beauregard that he would be attacked soon. She also sent a map used by the Senate Military Affairs Committee showing how the Union Army would reach Manassas Junction. Then, on the morning of July 16th, Mrs. Greenhow wrote a 9-word message. She gave it to a man to carry to Beauregard. The Confederate general received it that evening. It said, "Order given for McDowell to march upon Manassas tonight." Beauregard sent a telegram to Richmond. He told the Confederate government that McDowell was on the way. He asked that Johnston's 10,000-man force in the Shenandoah Valley join him for battle. He was told to expect Johnston's help. But Johnston's army was threatened by a large Union force that entered Virginia from Maryland. Led by General Robert Patterson, the Union troops moved toward the smaller Confederate force. They were not really interested in fighting Johnston, but they did want to prevent him from reaching Beauregard. Johnston knew he could not defeat Patterson, so he decided to trick him. While most of his army withdrew and prepared to join Beauregard, Johnston sent a small force to attack Patterson's army. Patterson believed Johnston was attacking with all his troops. He stopped moving forward and prepared to defend against what seemed to be a strong Confederate attack. By the time the trick was discovered, Johnston and most of his troops were at Manassas. General McDowell's huge Union army left Arlington on the afternoon of July 16th. It was a hot day, and the road was dusty. The march was not well organized, and the men traveled slowly. They stopped at every stream to drink and wash the dust from their faces. Some of the soldiers left the road to pick fruits and berries from bushes along the way. To some of those who watched this army pass, the lines of soldiers in bright clothes looked like a long circus parade. Most of these men had not been soldiers long. Their bodies were soft and they tired quickly. It took them 4 days to travel the 45 kilometers to Centerville, the final town before Bull Run. The battle would start the next morning, Sunday, July 21st. The road from Washington was crowded early Sunday morning with horses and wagons bringing people to watch the great battle. Hundreds of men and women watched the fight from a hill near Centerville. Below them was Bull Run. But the battleground was covered so thickly with trees that the crowds saw little of the fighting. They could, however, see the smoke of battle, and they could hear the sounds of shots and exploding shells. From time to time, Union officers would ride up the hill to report what a great victory their troops were winning. In the first few hours of the battle, Union forces were winning. McDowell had moved most of his men to the left side of Beauregard's army. They attacked with artillery and pushed the Confederate forces back. It seemed that the Confederate defense would break. Some of the Southern soldiers began to run, but others stood and fought. One Confederate officer, trying to prevent his troops from moving back, pointed to a group led by General T.J. Jackson of Virginia. "Look," he shouted, "there is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Fight like the Virginians." The Confederate troops refused to break. The fighting was fierce. The air was full of flying bullets. A newsman wrote that the whole valley was boiling with dust and smoke. A Confederate soldier told his friend, "Them Yankees are just marching up and being shot to hell." Neither side would give up. Then a large group of Johnston's troops arrived by train and joined in the fight. Suddenly, Union soldiers stopped fighting and began pulling back. General McDowell and his officers tried to stop the retreat, but failed. Their men wanted no more fighting. The fleeing Union soldiers threw down their guns and equipment, thinking only of escape. Many did not stop until they reached Washington. It was a bitter defeat, but it made the North recognize the need for a real army, one trained and equipped for war. President Abraham Lincoln gave the job of building such an army to General George McClellan.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.